I am Dr. Reg Ackerley, and welcome to The Morning Voice. With us this morning in studio is Ackerley Advertising CEO and the number one person engaged with The Morning Voice, Morgan Murphy. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning.
Thanks for doing all you do for The Morning Voice and for Ackerley Advertising. You got about 6 weeks left, and you're going to be an edumacated person, right?
Yes, yeah.
You're going to get your master's in marketing at the University of Arizona. We're going to have a big party for you.
Big party.
Yeah, to celebrate nice. Your graduation.
So, her follow-through was impeccable.
It is. She's pretty good.
She is very good.
She was after you, wasn't she?
She was.
Yeah.
Very good, Morgan.
Bill Ackerley is here. My very good friend, my wonderful, fantastic friend, Marie Fortney is here. Good morning, Marie. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
So great to see you and to reminisce about the past and your folks and everything. We've known each other a long time, haven't we?
I was just thinking this morning about your wife was one of my first swim coaches ever in my life.
Well, that's
probably
great.
I was about 10 years old, I think, and I, you know, she perfected my backstroke.
Yeah, she is a backstroker, and she is very, 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 very passionate about swimming. So she said, you know, she has a little company during the summer. She goes around and teaches little, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 year olds.
Oh, nice.
Especially for people who have a pool in their backyard and the kid needs to know how to swim.
So she, right, yeah.
She goes and
for
teaches
safety.
Them. Yeah, it's really kind of cool. Yeah. And my other really good friend. Hello, Alan Michaels. How are you?
It's too late.
Yeah.
Too late.
The voice. Alan Michaels, the voice.
We've had a lot of fun over the years.
We have.
We've done a lot of things together. And we started a lot of things that people have no idea how they got started, but Ed Ackerley and Alan Michaels and the Ackerley Advertising and the radio stations I was at, we put it all together.
I often try to tell people that you and I were the ones that started that. What you see at football games now, you and I started that. There was nobody on the lawn in front of McHale, and you and I had the very first big, giant tailgate party. We did it for a couple of years.
Subway sandwiches?
Yeah, and then they...
And Coors Light.
Coors Light, and they came and made me meet with them and asked me how I did that. How did I get the radio station? How did I get Coors Light? How did I get Subway involved in this thing? And then, are you making money off this? I didn't know. 500,000 people would come to those tailgates.
Yep.
That was long before they started charging and what you see today.
Exactly.
It was amazing. We were the first.
We had a blast doing that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we ever saw a game during those.
No, actually, I had season tickets all those years. And what I did is I gave those tickets away just so I could listen to the game on our sister radio station,
right.
KNST at the time.
Right.
And we would sit and drink beer and have Subway sandwiches and invite people in. People we don't even know. Come on.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. Yeah,
Great times.
Well, Marie, you're doing great work for the community, and we thank you for that.
Thanks.
Especially when it comes to little guys. And so you're the executive director of the Child Advocacy Center here in Tucson?
Yeah.
And Children's Advocacy
Center? I sure
Center.
Am. And it's such an honor to be part of that. We say we're the place where abuse ends and healing begins for kids.
Right.
We serve about 1,000 kids and their families every year.
Can I tease you?
Sure.
Remember 6 years ago when we had an event at your place and you made a big announcement
podium. No, you can't tease me about that. This is like when people ask me about my embarrassing moments. It was the worst.
Matt, I got to tell you. It's not bad. It's funny,
yes,
actually.
Yes, it is bad.
It was awful. She said, we had this big, there was my 300 people in this room. I don't know how many people.
It was actually our press conference for Child Abuse Prevention Month, which is April.
So it was this big meeting, and all the players and movers and shakers in the world were there. And she goes, "I'm really, 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 really pleased to have a mayoral candidate with us today, a fantastic representative of our community, and has making a run for the mayor of the city of Tucson. Please join me in welcoming Steve Farley."
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there.
Oh my God, he's like chopped liver.
And it went by. And she never acknowledged me or anything. And I was a candidate. I was actually a candidate before Steve Farley.
Yeah.
Steve is a wonderful friend of ours. We love Steve. And
I can tell you that my board, and particularly there's one board member who has since retired from the board, but who's more politically savvy. Well, obviously, that's a low bar to be more politically savvy than I am, but she read me the riot act on that. She said, A, you do not announce candidates, and B, if you start announcing, you announce everybody. And I was like, I couldn't even see who was in the room. I was so nervous.
That was hilarious. I'm not ever letting you forget that.
So clearly.
I bring it up almost every time I see you.
Is that the reason why you lost?
Yeah. It is.
Oh, that was it. That moment.
I'm a two-time loser, as they say.
No,
so that's
you're
what
not.
Susie
okay.
calls
no.
me. So anyway,
no,
let's move on to Children's Advocacy Center, and you're the executive director. I want you to tell us a little bit about what the center does and what you do there every day and the wonderful work that you and
sure.
your group do.
Yeah, it's, we don't like to think about child abuse in our community, but it's important, and especially for April Child Abuse Prevention Month, it's important to shine a light on the fact that this is happening. There are about 9,000 investigations into child abuse every year in Pima County.
Wow.
Like I said, we see about 1,000 of those cases. They're the most intense, to put a word to it, that's where there's going to be some kind of investigation. So law enforcement's involved, child welfare's involved. And our goal is to make sure that that process is not traumatizing for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Before we had a Children's Advocacy Center, kids might have been interviewed up to 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
And they might have had to tell their story in the back of a squad car to a scary person wearing a gun. Not that they're nice people. And there might have had to get their medical care in the emergency room. And now instead they can come to our warm and friendly advocacy center that was literally designed for this work to minimize trauma for kids. And that's where they right. get their care. The goal is to do the interview just one time. And our goal is always to focus on the healing needs of the kids.
And you're located right over there on Aho, across from the biggest landmark there is the stadium. So you're right north of the stadium there.
Yep.
Beautiful facility. That's where we were. Had that big event, and
yes.
we didn't get to tour all of it because there are some places that you don't really want people to go see, and
yeah.
because there's kids there. So
right, and yeah. when there are kids in there having that investigation, we want to make sure that their confidentiality is protected.
Right.
So yeah, I always invite people for a tour, and I love to give tours, but sometimes you come and I say, I'm sorry, I can't give you a tour.
Right. So, Alan,
yes.
This is Child Abuse Awareness Month, so April. So obviously, the mayoral candidates come and
stop. I'm not doing that again.
Okay, all right, sounds good. So, Alan, so what your job at the Children's Advocacy Center is to help in development, obviously, but also to help spread the word about what the good things are that are happening at the Children's Advocacy Center. So this is Child Abuse Awareness Month. And so what have you been doing in terms of trying to spread the awareness of child abuse?
Well, we're going to be looking to do some PSAs on Bustos Media, your station.
Oh, qué bueno.
And,
qué bueno.
And getting the word out as far as our events. We just basically are hitting people and talking to them about raising money for our organization, which we need to do to keep the kids from being abused,
right.
basically.
We
got to get the word out because, as Marie mentioned earlier, people don't talk about it.
Right.
They don't talk about it because they feel it's not in my backyard.
Right.
You know,
right.
it's somewhere else. It's not
And even
here.
If it is in their backyard, they don't want to talk about it because they're part of it. So
right.
you know, it's just one of those things you don't want to talk about either
yeah,
way.
And yeah. it doesn't matter what part of the city you're from, what part of the community
right.
you're from. It doesn't matter how much money you make or how much money you don't make. It still happens to people that Yeah. many that you know.
And defenseless little guys that have a hard time defending themselves. It's hard to, when they become an abuse victim, it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's absolutely terrible.
I mean, I say always it's every adult's responsibility to take care of the kids. We can't leave it up to them.
Right. You've got a couple of events coming up before we talk about the big one after the break. So tell us a little bit about what's happening tomorrow at the Reed Park.
Tomorrow at Reed Park is our Family Fun Fair. It's our biggest outreach event of the year. We partner with over 30 organizations that come to share about their resources and the services they can provide. Lots of families need a little bit of help sometimes, and there's no shame in that. And we think it should be fun to learn mm-hmm. about those resources and to get that help that you might need later. And so there are activities for the kids. There's clowns, glitter tattoos, crafts, games, food, and a DJ.
Great for
a good time.
Grandparents to bring their grandkids
oh,
to
for
as
sure.
well. Yeah, fun,
yeah,
a fun thing to do in the park right next to Reed Park Zoo. So
yeah.
maybe take a little detour afterwards and
for
go
sure.
see the zoo. So what time will that start and how long does it last?
It's 10 to 1.
10 to
so
1.
So right over the lunch hour, and there's food. There will be food trucks, and it's a good time. It's really fun.
And so it's just to the west of
just west
of
the zoo
of the zoo mm-hmm. there in the
it's
festival
called,
area yeah.
yeah
Right. Okay. So that's tomorrow at Reed Park, the Family Fun Fest, Family Fun Fair. And then on the end of the month, you have Go Blue for Kids Day on Friday, April 25th. That's a unique event. Tell us what that is.
That's a fun one, and it's easy to engage. It's a great way to help spread awareness about child abuse. You just wear blue, and then you take a selfie, and you post it on social media, tagging us, CACSOAZ, and then the hashtag Go Blue for Kids AZ.
Okay, and that is basically the culmination of a month of awareness, is trying to get people to, you know, as Alan, as you said, get them talking about it and getting them having a discussion about it.
And I have to throw this at you, because not only are we going to be at the Reed Park tomorrow, I'm going to be down at Desert Diamond Casino in Suwanee.
Of course you are. Oh, at an event.
A car show.
Oh, okay.
An official event.
Representing the Children's Advocacy Center.
So that's, I'm probably going to be with you. That's where I am going. I'm going with
you. So I'm down there between 9 and 3.
The one off the freeway?
Yes.
The big one?
Pima Mine Road.
Pima Mine Road. And what's the car? What are the cars that are going to be there?
It's going to be mostly a GM show.
Okay.
And we were there last year. The same date that we were at Reed Park, I was at Desert Diamond. So,
can you do both? No.
I can't.
You can't be two places.
Well,
you
used Alan can't, but a person could.
You used to be two places at the same time. You still are every once in a while. So,
but no, I'm down there doing that.
And what time does that one run?
That's 9 to 3 tomorrow.
9 to 3. Yep. And that's how many cars? 100
probably cars? Probably 150, 200
cars.
Oh,
wow. That's a lot of cars.
A lot of cars.
Yeah. And then you have a booth there. And
I will have a table there with lots of information.
Are you emceeing that event?
No, I'm not.
No. The golden tones of Alan Michaels at Desert Diamond Casino. Hey, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about your big event coming up in just a couple of days, the Great Heroes Without Capes event. We're talking to Marie Fortney and Alan Michaels from the Children's Advocacy Center here in Southern Arizona. You're listening to The Morning Voice. We'll be back after the break.
With the Carpenters.
Matt, we're pounding on the desk in here.
I wanted some kids singing for you, you know?
Yeah, we love that.
A candy man can. One of the Rat Pack.
Yeah, we're with two of our wonderful friends, Marie Fortney, Executive Director of the Children's Advocacy Center, and our longtime family friend and professional colleague, Alan Michaels. Good morning both to you again.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you very much for having us today. We appreciate
it. It's great to have you here with us.
Matt, you're doing a great job as always, buddy.
Keeping it together with duct tape and chewing gum and a couple of paper clips.
Radio hasn't changed.
Yeah, that's right. Same as it was.
Yeah, that's great. So you have a great mission at the Children's Advocacy Center, and that's safety for kids who are having issues in family life or whatever. It's a really important thing that you do, right, Marie?
It's amazing and really fulfilling. You know, we see really horrible things that have happened, very intense cases of child abuse, but I leave that building filled with hope every day because kids are resilient, and we get to be part of making that difference in their lives and helping them begin to heal.
And speaking about hope, we have a great event coming up in a couple of days called the Heroes Without Capes Award. And so, Alan, tell us a little bit about that wonderful event and what you got planned.
It is the third annual Heroes Without Capes Awards event coming up next Friday, April 11th at the Hilton El Conquistador, 10,000 North Oracle Road. The event kicks off about 5:30 with a happy hour. Some fabulous, fabulous raffle prizes. I mean, beyond awesome raffle prizes. We'll have a delicious dinner, and we'll have award ceremonies to those in the community who help prevent children from being abused. And it's going to be an evening of a couple of live auction items. It's going to be a big fundraising event. You'll be done if you show up by 9 o'clock.
Right.
So it's going to be a great evening. It's going to be Tucson casual dress. Come, expect a great night of fun.
Wait. It's not Tucson casual dress. I bought a gown, Alan. If you tell people to come casual, I'm just going to... Please don't come casual. Please dress up. It's our awards gala. What the heck with this guy?
You got to be careful in Tucson. You might get a couple of people coming in Huarache sandals and a Guayabera shirt, so, which is, I guess, okay. Mayor Lou Murphy, he said that from Memorial Day to Labor Day, it was the Guayabera shirt, the Mexican wedding shirt.
Exactly, But it's going to be a great night. You'll have some fun, you'll help us raise some money, and you'll walk away informed of what the CAC really is all about.
And it's gala. It's gala attire.
Yeah, definitely. Dress nice. Dress I mean, nice. It is Tucson, so if you don't have a gown, it's fine. You wear what you have. And we, you know, you come as you are. We appreciate everybody just being there and learning about these amazing kids.
How many people do you expect to be at the event, Heroes Without Capes?
We're thinking about 250 or so. Yeah. That's where we're at right now.
And you still have some tickets left if people want to get involved?
Yes.
And tell them how they can get the tickets and what they get with the tickets. Yeah.
Well, depending on where you want to be, we still have sponsorships available. Right. We have our hero sponsor. Let me plug the hero sponsors.
Do, please do.
BMW of Tucson, located in the Auto Mall on Wetmore.
That's great. That's very nice of them.
The Jeff and Jennifer Abbott Family Foundation.
Great.
And Southwest Gas Corporation, our hero sponsors.
That's fantastic.
Great people.
Read off some of the other ones that
champion are sponsors include Southwest Heritage Bank.
Great.
And we also have the Mahoney Group, Mercy Care, and one of our board members, Jane Henninger, who's a great lady, terrific lady. Our award sponsors are Fleet Feet, two locations, one east side, one northwest.
Good people.
Our advocate sponsors, Encompass Health, HSL Properties, Tomlinson Financial, and Brad and Anita Fader.
Oh, that's great. Some of our good friends there helping out, and that's fantastic. So, you know, it takes a village, doesn't it, as they say? You know,
it
takes sponsors, it takes the community, it takes law enforcement, it takes the courts, it takes so many different things, and volunteers, too.
Yeah. All of our work is collaborative, and we've been, you know, for 28 years, the Children's Advocacy Center has been that place where abuse ends and healing begins. And what we've learned is two important things. The first is that families really need wraparound services in order to heal, and there's really no limit to what they might need. A lot of times the abuser is also the person paying the bills in the home. So you can really think about anything a family might need, and we find a connection to that for that family.
Especially if you have to separate that abuser from the family, then where are you now?
Yeah. For sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the other thing we've learned is that we can't do this alone, and we need support, not just from our partners in law enforcement and child welfare and the services in the community, but also the people in the community that support what we do, the people who are coming to this event, our sponsors, you know, people who provide the raffle prizes. Right. We've got some really cool prizes for our auction this year. There's a pearl necklace from La Jolla Diamonds and Gems, and there's a Mexican cruise for two from Sea Dog Travel. So, I mean, really amazing prizes and a good time, and all of it is just about this. It's all people who just believe in what we do and care about children and want to help us protect children.
Right.
I also want to thank you, Dr. Ed Ackerley, because you helped me get some great prizes this year.
Great.
As always.
I like to point out that Russell True, whenever we ask, he gives us something at the True Ranch Collection, and that's always a...
And Grant Kruger,
our Wednesday host. He's great. He's a great supporter. We have some good people.
And the team at the Children's Advocacy Center is second to none.
Yeah.
Those ladies do a great job.
That's great. And so when we talk about wraparound services and so forth, what happens to the child? Just curious, you know, you give them... obviously, you step in when you need to, when there's a crisis, and then you help get them kind of back head in direction. This is an interesting question I have. Does anybody ever come back, you know, been 28 years, you know, 10 years later and say, hey, you helped me and I want to help you?
For sure. We have actually now what we call our Voices Council, and they're high school aged now, but they're survivors of childhood abuse. Mm-hmm. And they support us in all our programming. They're volunteers, and they inform our work by telling us about their own experience, what was good, what could be improved, and then looking at systems. We have a couple of times they have sat down with the Department of Child Safety to talk to them about processes, first to understand more, but secondly, to give some advice about how things could be different and how maybe they could do a better job of protecting kids. And they give us advice all the time. One of the critical things that happened was that one of our Voices Council members a couple of years ago told us about how even though she was safe in her home and her mom was technically supportive, she was being blamed for what happened to her, that somehow she must have seduced her stepdad.
Right.
And so she said that what would have been great would have been to have her own advocate. And what what traditionally happens in a children's advocacy center is that while the child is getting their interview and exam, then the advocate is meeting with the family member. And a lot of times it's in this kind of situation when it's sexual abuse, the mom is kind of in shock. She's blaming herself for what her husband has done. And then, of course, panicked because she's having to pay the bills. So she's getting this one-on-one support from an advocate. And what our Voices Council member told us is that she also needed that. Mm-hmm. So we created a child advocate position to support the kids. Any child who's old enough to have a conversation gets a conversation about what supports they have in their life beyond their parents. Because sometimes the parents are really supportive and amazing, but a little bit overwhelmed about right. the whole court process and the resources they're trying to access. So, there's that. And then there are resources that kids can access without parent permission, you know, like hotlines, suicide mm-hmm. lines, supports at school, like school counselors. And so we have that whole supportive conversation for the kids as well.
That's fantastic. So, Alan, if someone wanted to help, how do they get a hold of you and what do they do?
The best way to do it is to go online, mm-hmm. cacsoaz.org, or you can call me. My direct line, you can call me on my mobile. I will give you my mobile okay. number.
I love it.
520-240-6000. That's okay. my personal mobile number. Call me and anything you can do
donate,
to help.
Donate. Yeah.
Whatever you can.
Buy a ticket. Donate. Come to the event. Go tomorrow to the Reed Park. Wear blue on the 25th right. and tag Children's Advocacy Center. You guys do great work. Thank you so much for being here this morning, and thank you for what you do for little guys in our community. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you,
Ed.
Thank you.
We'll be back after the break with our good friend Carlos Ruiz. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI, 10:30 a.m. Love it. It kind of feels like we're at Old Home Week here, you know, to have Alan Michaels and Marie in. That was fantastic to talk about the Children's Advocacy Center. And then, and now I have to say that our next guest was actually the
another mayoral candidate.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Mayor of Tinkaverde.
Mayor of Tinkaverde. Yeah. Yeah. I do have to say that you were one of the first people to become a sponsor of what we called back then Jump in Tucson. And you gave us the very first check, I think, that we got for to get the Jump in Tucson. And look where we are now. Now we're Morning Drive, and we've got, we're into this about 15-16 months, and we're doing our thing. Our good friend Chris is on his way doing some other things right now, and it's kind of nice to move into this 7 to 9 a.m. slot Monday through Friday. But Carlos, you were one of the first ones to help us out and get us going, so thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So this is Carlos Ruiz, a familiar voice on KVOI. You've been helping out and doing some things for many years in the community, and you're an avid letter to the editor writer and editorial writer. You've been engaged in the political process for many, many years, but you actually have a real job, and that is to you're the owner of HT Metals. Tell us a little bit about that company.
Yeah, HT Metals is a custom cutting raw material distributor. Our tagline is customize, source, prosper. So what we do is we get the raw material, we cut custom shapes, supply it to precision machine shops so that they can focus on the their manufacturing process and prosper that way, and we just take care of the right. sourcing.
Our president is big on talking about we need to bring manufacturing back to the United States from overseas, and I'm not going to say you're a huge part of that, but you are a part of that because you are allowing people to manufacture right here in the States.
Yeah, and actually, back in 2020 during COVID, we stayed open, and supply chains were really affected back then. We have one very large customer now that was getting their material from China. They were mm-hmm. having these custom shapes produced in China. Well, that material was not coming out of China.
Right.
So they came to us. I'd been approaching them. Mm-hmm. Always the pricing wasn't quite right. They're supposedly, all of a sudden, we need these parts.
Right.
So we jumped in and started supplying them, got them through COVID, right. and we were able to retain them. We'd done some deals, pump up. We did some pump upgrades so that we could improve our efficiency and our productivity so that we could be competitive with Chinese, and all of a sudden, all that stuff, it's now here being produced in Tucson, Arizona,
That's
instead
great.
Of being put on a know, produced in China.
Put on a barge and
put on a container and brought over here to the United States. So, yeah. I mean, there are success stories. And I think small businesses, you know, my little success story is multiplied.
Right.
Thousands and thousands of times across this country. I think that's one of the things that during this time right mm-hmm. now of uncertainty, I don't think people realize that there will be opportunities.
Right.
There's going to be some things that are still going to stay
right.
overseas because the cost structure or whatever just doesn't.
Like we were talking about minerals, there are some minerals you just can't mine them in the United States efficiently like they have in other places.
Correct. Right? Yeah. So some things are going to stay, and I'm not really that concerned because I actually have been through this already.
Right.
In 2017, Trump had tariffs on steel and aluminum, just like right. he's doing now. And what happened? We did. You know, unfortunately, see a drastic rise in our cost of goods sold. Took about 3 months to kind of work through that. And then over the long term, what ended up happening is adjusted the right. prices. So yes, domestic materials went up because they took advantage of these tariffs, but then demand changes, and so they had to bring their prices down to move their metal.
Right.
Now, what ends up happening is that the Chinese, who already had a lower cost structure than the United States, they now had to eat that 25% tariff.
Right. Right.
So,
in order to be competitive,
and prices slowly drifted back. With I would say within 6 to 9 months, back to where they were. Right.
If you can kind of live with a little bit of a pain in the short right. run, the long-term gain is little bit of pain for a lot of gain.
Right. Yeah. And then what ended up happening with the Chinese, they started changing their behaviors, and there were some trade deals and what right. have you that were taking place long-term. So I think...
And what's great about your company is you're nimble because right. you're a little bit smaller. Right. You're not like trying to turn a gigantic...
multinational around. Yeah. I can...
Make the decisions.
I make the decisions, right.
So you can decide right. whether or not you're going to take on something and become that guy.
Yeah.
So it's kind of nice for you because you have the ability to be nimble is a good right. word for it.
Right. right.
Yeah. Well, I know we're supposed to be talking about something else, but before we get there, let's talk a little bit about how's it going in the city of Tucson? How do you think things are going in our wonderful... You're such an advocate for what we do here. And how
are
we doing?
We just had the shoot down of, right. of Prop 414. Right. I've actually been going to some of these. The city of Tucson is having these town halls.
Right.
So I've been to two of them.
Right.
I went to the
there
one.
There was one last night on budget.
There was one last night at Udall.
Right.
Well, I went to the one at El Pueblo, and I also went to the one at Randolph, which mm-hmm. was on Tuesday and Wednesday. Same people show up.
Right.
Because I was there twice.
You said the exact same people.
Besides me, it was kind of somewhat of the same people.
Yeah.
It's interesting, looking nationally and what kind of waste and fraud that they're mm-hmm. finding at right. the federal level, imagine that. That's happening throughout.
Right.
That's not just happening at the federal level. It's got to be happening at the state. It's got to be happening at the county. It's got to be happening at the city level,
and some of it is not intentional per se. It's just that it's kind of grown like topsy and inefficiencies.
And I think also the things that I find frustrating is the priorities. You have these, I would say a faction of people that are very hyper focused on, they say homelessness, but it's really trying to, it's a philosophy of if everybody had a home,
right?
If everybody had a place to live, then all of a sudden crime, everything would be solved. And because there was actually a person that stated that on Tuesday,
right.
that basically stated his philosophy was that if homeless,
low barrier, how, low entry
housing,
housing was
given to everyone, society would be wonderful. And I think it's been proven that without the treatment, without the care, without the healing of addicts or people with mental health, that will not happen. That will not happen. Yeah. So you have these two really disparate mindsets. And I think I'm more of the camp of we got to make sure that we have fire, police, public safety. That is the key. That's the key thing. So I think there's these two.
Yeah. I don't want to speak for Lisa Chastain, the director of the Gospel Rescue Mission, but she does say that just giving somebody a house doesn't solve the problem.
Right.
There's core issues that either mental or drug abuse or whatever, that just giving them a house or giving them low entry, low barrier, what you have is now a messed up house.
Right.
With the copper out of the air conditioner and, the
and
place
the
a mess.
Staying inside, living this
horrible
lawless lifestyle inside inside four walls.
Yeah, which is not good. So we got a lot of work to do. Yeah. I know the 414 didn't pass, but I think that we aptly named Speedway because we just don't have enough police officers. People are going 60, 70, 80 miles an hour down Speedway, and we've just got to get some more police officers. But, you do that with a priority of the budget. With $2.4 billion, you ought to be able to find enough money to get us some more police officers.
Yeah.
So it's all based on priority.
It is definitely priorities.
Yeah. And so thank you for your advocacy of what you're doing for the city of Tucson and your continual prodding along. We're talking to Carlos Ruiz, who is the owner of HT Metals. And ironically, that went fast because we're going to come back and we're going to talk about one of the great things that Carlos does for us. It's called Tucson Taste of Chocolate, and we'll get back and talk about that after the break. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI 1030 AM. Now a word from our wonderful sponsors. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Here with Morgan Murphy. Good morning again, Morgan.
Good morning.
You like teachers, don't you?
I do.
Who's your favorite teacher? Just tell me who you think your favorite teacher of yours. You have to think about that one for a long time.
There
are so many good teachers.
Dr. Acton is probably my favorite teacher, though.
I have loaded questions. If you haven't noticed, I ask students at the U of A, who's your favorite teacher? And they go, Dr. Nielsen's fantastic. Dr. Venkataramani is fantastic. And they go through their lists, and I look at them and say, I can change your grade up to 1 year afterward. So, Carlos, you like teachers, don't you?
Oh, yes. I've been involved in education for probably 10 years.
Tancredi School District.
Tancredi School District. And now I'm on the Arizona State Board for Charter Schools.
That's fantastic. Well, you're involved in a lot of things, and one of the things you're involved in is Rincon Rotary. Tell us a little bit about Rincon Rotary.
Yeah, Rincon Rotary, it's a smaller Rotary club. We meet on the east side at the Tucson Country Club. We have lunches every other week.
Mm-hmm.
Our signature fundraiser is the Taste of Chocolate. And our, every Rotary Club kind of has a focus of what they give.
Right.
And our thing is education. Mm-hmm. We give grants directly to teachers throughout the Valley here. These are grants to district public schools, charter schools. It doesn't matter private schools that the teacher just sends in fills out a form on the Rotary Local is our rotarylocal.org is the website. They can submit a grant saying, hey, I want to I fulfilled a grant for a garden. It was like a raised bed garden at a charter high school. And we bought some seeds and we constructed the thing and presented it. And what we also try to do is buy whatever they want. We buy it, we supply it, and we try to use local businesses to fulfill whatever it is that the teachers want. And so our signature fundraiser is next Sunday, the 12th, let me get my
13th.
The 13th.
Right.
It's Palm Sunday, the 13th. It's at the Doubletree at Reed Park, and it's called The Taste of Chocolate. And we'll have just the ballroom is going to be filled with chocolatiers giving samples of their chocolate away to people walking through. It's from 2 to 4 on April 13th.
Right.
And tickets are $20. Mm-hmm. The tickets can be purchased at tasteofchocolate.org, and this is how we raise money to give to the teachers. We've raised usually about 30,000, and we give out 30,000 last 12 months, we've given out pretty close to $30,000 to local teachers here in Tucson.
So what you raise at the Taste of Chocolate event then goes right back into supporting teachers and education and kids. Obviously, if you support teachers in schools and so forth, you're supporting children.
Right.
And that's a really important thing. Point of personal privilege, my wife retired from the U of A, and then she went to work as a first grade teacher for 25 years or more, almost 30 years now, I guess. And she retired last May, but she's back in the classroom because the young lady that took her place had a baby, so she's now on long-term subbing. So she's back in the classroom again. But I am evidence to the amount of money that my wife spent over the last 25 years supporting her classroom. And she works at a private school, and they get a lot of support and so forth, and a lot of donations and everything. But she's still, the Amazon man. He knew our first names because stuff would come full time to our house. And my wife spent so much money on support. And fortunately, we had the money to be able to help her to do that. But these teachers need help. Classrooms need help. And whether it be something fun like a garden, which is really important in education and so forth, but just classroom support is really important.
Yes. And most of the grants are like $500, $600.
Right.
So we can do a lot. With $30,000, we can do a lot of teachers.
Right.
Help a lot of classrooms.
You'd be surprised what $500 could get to a first grade teacher at a private school when you got 20 kids, and how far that would actually stretch, which is really helpful. Doesn't seem like much, but it is a really important amount.
Another interesting thing that we're starting to get into, vocational supporting a vocational education. So these are grants that would go directly to a person. So say somebody's doing vocational education at Pima College and they're precision manufacturing, he needs to buy some tools. They can petition and submit a grant and say, hey, I'd like to get some money. And so there's even that mechanism now that we're supporting.
If I know Rotary well, you're always recruiting potential members for Rotary, right?
Yes.
Limited, but that there are some opportunities available there if someone's interested.
Oh, there's always opportunities at our club, and it's a smaller club. We just had a meeting yesterday. There was 20 people there.
Right.
We're usually in the 20 to 30 person range.
So if someone wanted to support the Taste of Chocolate or get some more information about Rincon Rotary, how do they get a hold of Carlos Ruiz, or where do they go to get the info?
They could reach me at info@htmetals.com.
Okay.
And I'll share my phone number and what have you info@htmetals.com.
And where can they get tickets for the Taste of Chocolate?
They can get tickets at tasteofchocolate.org.
Oh, great. Got your own website there. That's great.
And then... Or they can look up Rincon Rotary. You can Google Rincon Rotary Club of Tucson, and that'll go to our page.
Thanks for all you do for so many people in Tucson. You're a wonderful advocate for what's doing the right thing for the right reasons, and we appreciate all you do.
Thank you.
And thank you for being your supporting initial guy, helping us out with the Jump in Tucson and now the Morning Voice. We appreciate you and appreciate all you do. And your wife, Cindy, wonderful, wonderful family, and thank you for all the good things.
Yep, you're welcome. Thank you.
That's the great Carlos Ruiz, and this is The Morning Voice. We'll be back with Wonder from the University of Arizona after the break. Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice, this Wonder series where we talk about the wonderful things happening at the University of Arizona. A lot going on. We're gearing up for about 6 weeks from now, the graduation of a bunch of undergrads who are moving out into the workforce and some going on to a higher degree, a master's degree. You, my dear, Morgan Murphy, you're going to be graduating with a master's in marketing degree here coming up pretty quick.
Yes, very exciting.
We're going to have a big party to celebrate celebrate your success at the University of Arizona. Wonder is all about great research, great outcomes, student outcomes, about all the good things that are happening at the University of Arizona. And research is part of that. And one of the interesting things we're going to talk about is some 3D technology for eye tracking. And we have a couple of, we said we weren't going to call you doctors, but we got a couple of doctors here with us, Dr. Willemitzer and Dr. Wang, who are with a new technology of 3D eye tracking. So good morning and welcome.
Morning.
Morning.
But tell me, before we get started on your research and so forth, why are you at the university? How did you get here?
Yeah, so actually I'm originally coming from Germany. So Germany. I'm Florian Willumitzer. Hi. Originally, I'm coming from Germany. I did my PhD in Germany, and then I actually landed in Chicago for my postdoc, where I worked on computational imaging, a lot of 3D imaging, and imaging through scattering media. This is also something that we are doing in our lab. So this means, like, for example, imaging through fog or smoke or tissue.
Being able to see through things you can't see through. Yeah.
Things like this. But this is not what we will talk about today. But yeah.
How'd you get to the U of A?
Yeah. Actually, so, you know, in our field, we call our field computational imaging. And computational imaging has a big optics component. So you need to know a lot about optics. And if you know a little bit about the history of optics in Arizona, you know that this is actually like one of the best places you can go to. So it's one of the hotspots in US for optics. And as soon as I got the offer from Arizona, I actually didn't hesitate very long to come here.
That's great. Well, welcome and thanks for being here. Dr. Wang, how did you get to the University of Arizona?
So actually, I was the PhD student in Northwestern University, working closely with Florin. So actually, when Florin decided to transfer to Arizona, and he offered me, "Do you want to go with me?" I was still in the middle of my PhD journey. So I say, "Yeah, let me have a try first, because I know like UFA has the best one of the best optical program in the world." So I was visiting SCADA here for 1 year before I graduate, and after I graduate, I said, "Oh yeah, this is the right place. I should to continue my research career." So I just joined Florin again and to be a postdoc here in his lab.
That's fantastic. So you've developed a groundbreaking 3D eye technology. Can you just give us a quick overview of what this 3D eye tracking technology is and what you're doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, eye tracking is actually an important enabling technology, is how we call it, for many different disciplines. Probably the most well-known discipline nowadays is the application in virtual reality headsets and augmented reality headsets, because the long-term goal is that you, navigate the user interface purely with your eye movement and not with a mouse or with hand movement or something like this anymore. And if you think a little bit how you navigate your computer right now. So for example, right now you navigate your computer with a mouse. And if you think that you in the future want to navigate your virtual reality headset user interface with the same precision that you can navigate your computer with a mouse, then you can actually like see pretty fast that you need a very accurate eye tracking technique. And but there are also other applications where eye tracking is used, especially like in the last decades, it was used a lot in medical imaging or psychology research. Cha-Chang, do you want to say?
Am I wrong to could be way off base here, so correct me if I'm wrong. But didn't someone like Stephen Hawking and so forth use eye movement as a way to move the cursor on the computer and be able to communicate?
Exactly.
So this has been used in a medical situation, right?
Yes, actually, in medical situation, like for kids or for some adults who have the problem of the focusing, so the researchers would like to use the eye tracking view, like to monitor their gazing directions where they are looking at, and then try to analyze their like their movement track, and then try to give them some like suggestions, and then so actually in those the medical imaging, especially in those medical imaging like applications for researchers, like they need a very very precise gaze direction estimation, much more better than the VR AR applications.
Right. And although we use all five of or six of our senses, depending on how you look at it, the eye is really, I think there's a statistic that maybe 63% to 82% or something like that of learning happens through eyes, and that yes, the ear and the smell and the taste and other things, the touch, are all important in learning, and we try to hit all the senses. eye is a really important part of learning for a human being, right?
Correct.
Yeah. No. So how is this technology different from the eye tracking systems that maybe have been in existence for years, and what makes this different?
So eye tracking has been like been studied for decades, like maybe 10 or 20 years ago. People, even for now, the photos commercial eye trackers, the most popular method is still what we call glint tracking. So glint tracking is like, for example, you have an AR VR headset,
right,
and in front of your eye, they have a ring of LED rings, small LEDs. For example, like they have from 2 to 12 LED rings, and then they also have two cameras or multiple cameras who can observe the reflection of those LED rings on your cornea, and then they analyze those the reflections, and then they can estimate your eye's position and your gaze. So in that one of the disadvantage of this method is like they're very just 2 to 12 glints, which is very sparse, which means that you couldn't get a lot of the denser information from your eye, which can deviate your estimation. But in our method, so actually we brought idea from one of the popular optical metrology method, which is called diffractometry, which means that you have a screen in front of your eye, surround your eye, and which displays a known pattern. For example, you have a pattern where you already know its structure, and then you observe the deformation of this pattern after reflection, and then you analyze this deformation, and then you can densely reconstruct your eye surfaces, including not only just the cornea, but also the white area, the sclera. So with this dense deformation, you can estimate the gaze, which is more robust, we would say.
That's great.
And then maybe to emphasize a little bit on this, so he said the current state-of-the-art techniques sample the eye surface at around, 10 to 12 of these point light sources. Now you can think, if you use a screen for that, every pixel on your screen acts as an individual point light source. So if you use a 1 megapixel screen, for example, then you have 1 million point light sources instead of 10 or 12 that tell you some information about your eye surface and also about the gaze. And this is basically what we are exploiting. So we are exploiting this higher information content in our work.
And how did you kind of, it's as a novice like me learning about optics and so forth, how does this advancement take place? What did you kind of build off of in order to get to this new technology?
Yeah, so this goes actually back to my PhD thesis in Germany. So I grew up, if you want to say it like this, in a group that was very focused on optical 3D metrology. So this was, optical 3D metrology is about the very precise and accurate 3D measurement of, for example, technical part or lenses, for example. It's also used in Arizona, for example, for astronomical mirrors, to measure astronomical mirrors. And as Chia Chang was saying, one of the very powerful techniques that you use in optical 3D metrology is deflectometry. And this is a technique, as I said, that is typically used to measure like smooth surfaces, specular surfaces, for example, for lens testing or for testing of astronomical mirrors. Right. And then it came up, this idea came up pretty quickly that you can actually also use this to measure the eye surface. So this is something that also people before us did. So for example, to quantify visual impairments of the eyes, by measuring the cornea surface. And then we basically had the idea that we can use the same thing for eye tracking as well. And this is
how it came. Very interesting. So we're talking with Dr. Willemitzer and Dr. Wang, who are working on brand new 3D technology for eye tracking. So another uninformed question that I have here, because I don't know a lot about this. Has any of this been done on animals, or is it all human? Is it all human tracking?
Yes, so that's actually targeted for humans, what we are doing. And right now, the only subjects where we have tests, so this is like still, early research, right? So the only subjects where we have tested it so far was basically Dr. Wang and a few of our students.
I love it.
I think I also have a measurement, right?
Yeah, we also test our foreheads.
That's great. He's not calling you an animal, is he? He's not. But it's so new that it's interesting. And isn't it true that the eye is just an amazing thing? It's how it's constructed and what it does, and transforming you know, sun's rays into optical things that hit our eye, and all of a sudden we can make some sense of reality. It's pretty amazing what the eye can do, right?
Yes, correct.
And you're exploiting that that ability for the eye to be able to translate that information to something meaningful.
Actually, the eye movement and eye gazing direction can give you a lot of information in the world, especially because, like we say, the VR AR may be the future. So you can imagine that if you have AR VR glasses, which is have very powerful functions, like they just observe your gaze direction. Maybe sometimes you didn't realize you want to see something, right, and they will provide to you.
That's great. When we come back after the break, we'll talk some more about 3D eye tracking technology and the new research that's been developed at the University of Arizona. This is the Wonder Series on The Morning Voice. We'll be back after a few words from our great sponsors. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am Dr. Ed Ackley, along with my good friend Morgan Murphy. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning.
The Morning Voice is five different hosts on five different days. On Monday, we have Lydia Aranda. She talks about rainmakers. On Tuesday, General Ted Maxwell. He's in talking about civic engagement. On Wednesday, we have Grant Kruger from Union Public House talking about good things to eat, because he does food for thought and restaurateurs and small business in Tucson. And then we have on Thursday, Tom Moulton, sponsored by Visit Tucson, the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. He talks about all the fun things you can do. 7 million visitors come to Tucson every year, and many of the things they do are things you should be doing all around the valley. And then on Fridays, we do two different versions. We do the morning 7 to 8, we do business success stories, and then From 8 to 9, we do Wonder, great things happening at the University of Arizona. With us this morning are Florian and Jajung, who are doctors in the optics side of things. They're looking at new 3D technology that paves the way for next generation eye tracking and coming up with some unique ways to track how we look at things. So before we get too far along, can you explain how this new technology that you're developing could help people with visual impairments or neurological conditions?
Yes, that's actually very interesting, because previously I was commenting on the 3D metrology aspect of things, right? Where the goal is basically that you measure the surface of parts with high accuracy. And a byproduct of our method is actually that we measure the eye surface with very high accuracy. Mm-hmm. And it actually turns out that a lot of visual impairments, not all, but a lot, are coming from deformations of your eye surface. So, for example, from deformations of your cornea. And what our technology theoretically enables is that we can do online correction of these visual impairments. So while we are measuring the eye surface, and if we have the the hardware that fits to this, then we can online correct for visual impairments.
That's very interesting. And this could affect people in the future, because one of the things we were talking about is maybe when you have a self-driving car and you're in a car. So tell us a little bit about how this might help in that situation when the car takes off and goes by itself. What are you doing as the passenger?
So actually, if in the car system, if we have very quick precise or accurate like eye trackers,
right,
and then it can help to monitor if the driver is focusing on driving, if they're looking at their phone, okay, for more than 2 seconds, then eye trackers will alarm you, okay, right, focus on the road.
That's great.
So actually, this is very helpful, beneficial, and maybe, for example, in the future, if the eye trackers in the car system can detect, okay, you are looking at those monitors, you want to see how fast you are driving, then if it detects that, it can just tell you about that, right?
Right.
You don't have to check by yourself and also check the map or something.
Yeah,
right?
That would be interesting. You know, we have a law in the state of Arizona that says you're not supposed to look at your cell phone while you're driving, at least hands off. It's supposed to be mounted, or you're supposed to be connected to the car system and not actually be holding it and looking at it. But I can see if someone was holding it and holding it down by their lap or in their console and they were moving their eyes down to look at that, the car could actually send a signal and say, you can't continue to drive like this if you're not looking at the road. We need to have you. And if the car is driving itself, you need to be awake in order for you to take over, in case you need to take over in certain sections.
True.
And the eye tracking could do all of that for you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So Did you get a grant for this? When you were working with U of A, did you get a grant? Did the U of A fund this?
So there was actually like some initial funding still when we were at Northwestern University. Right. But the main work, and also like the main work that was published now, was actually funded from my startup at University of Arizona. So probably know when you start out as a new faculty, you get startup funding,
right?
Which you know helps you to build your group and your buy some lab supplies and you know, basically build your lab. And we financed this study from my startup.
Well, that's you're going to need now another big grant to get you going for the future. Yeah. And so what challenges did you face when you were obviously working with each other is a challenge, right? Because you don't like each other, but no, I'm just teasing. what challenges did you face as you were trying to adapt this this from your doctoral thesis and so forth and moving into this research here at the U of A from Northwestern? Any challenges that you faced on this that are, you know, we remember that when we had that one problem, we got through it. Has there been anything, or has it been kind of pretty smooth?
You can talk about how you spend your first year.
So when Florian talked about metrology, so in metrology, all the metrology method, one of the biggest challenges is the calibration.
Right.
So for example, if you calibrate your system like by 1 millimeters off, then maybe your gaze direction will be off. Like in our situation, the gaze direction will be off like by 1 degree, which is not acceptable.
Right.
So when I started this project,
it's got to be precise, right?
Very, very precise, actually. Yeah. That the calibration determines everything afterwards.
Right.
So when I started with Florian in this project, actually for the first year, even the first and a half year of my PhD, I was just doing calibration.
Right.
For the basic diffractometry setup, and then transfer it to the eye tracking setup, because eye tracking application is very different from the conventional application of diffractometry. So in this situation, in this like a special situation, we have a compact system and we have like two cameras and one small screen, which requires like better calibration and a better algorithm for that. So we develop a specific calibration procedure for this eye tracking application. That took me 1 or 2 years.
Wow. Yeah. So we've talked about some applications this might be good for down the line. How close are we seeing this type of technology being incorporated into, whether it be self-driving cars, whether it be medical devices, whether it be AI and virtual reality things? How far away are we from getting your eye tracking system into the world?
I mean, so currently what we are doing is like early stage research, right? Mm-hmm. So what we have done now is we showed a proof of principle of the new method. Our setup is currently like a lab bench setup with a bunch of optical components. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And as you said, so we are currently looking for follow-up funding that can potentially help us to turn this into a real product. But it's still like a little bit away from this, right?
So what's next for your research? What collaborations or applications are on the horizon? As you move forward, you need funding to go to the next step. But what are you looking to do with this research?
Yes. So as I said, we are currently looking for partners. This can be either federal funding, but this also could be industry funding if somebody from the industry is interested in this. And the research can go in many directions. So as I said, it can turn into a concrete product. Yeah.
But it could focus in one area. It could focus in like medical, for instance. Exactly. It could really focus on that, and that could be the first development, and then it could move into other areas or virtual reality or something like that.
But it can also turn, for example, into like a subpart of a completely new method, right? Where we use our eye tracking technology to enable something that was not possible before, which would be like a little bit more on the research side then.
Right. So, Jiayong, are you going to try and stay in Tucson and stay at the U of A, or do you got feelers out to lots of different universities across the world?
Currently, I'm just continuing my research, the optical research in UFA, in the optical program, and to make my
your mark on the industry, right? Yeah.
Currently, I won't go to the academia. I enjoy.
Oh, you do want to go on? Yeah,
I enjoy doing the research.
Yeah, that's great. Well, maybe we can keep.
That's why I do the postdoc here.
Yeah, maybe we can try and keep you at the University of Arizona. Hopefully, we can make a position for him in the lab.
That would be great.
Yeah, that takes an act of Congress, and the Congress is the Board of Regents and the and the departments that you work for. I realize funding for a new a new position is always challenging. Well, fascinating research on 3D technology and eye tracking, and great that you've shared this information with us, and good luck to you both in the future as you figure out how to make this thing a meaningful part. So part of that technology transfer of from the lab bench to reality. It's kind of be fun to watch that happen. You thought about it in your doctoral program, and now you're getting to see the that coming to fruition. Pretty exciting, right?
That is actually very exciting for every researcher if you can see your method that you have developed turned into a real product, right? Mm-hmm. But in many cases, it does not happen.
Right.
So in many cases, it does not happen. And then you move on to the next
thing. But you're on the verge here of this being accepted and being used, right? Yeah. So it could be something pretty exciting.
So, yeah, the benefit of the things that we are doing in our lab is that many things we are doing are very on the applied side. So they have a concrete use in many industrial branches.
Yeah.
And this is why in many cases it actually gets picked up by the industry.
Well, thank you both for coming in this morning, and congratulations on the great research that you've done so far. And good luck to you as you move that forward into maybe some kind of reward of some kind down the line. Yeah. So thank you for being
thank
here this
morning.
Thank
you very much for thank having you. Us. Yeah.
Florian and Jung, who are they're doctors, so we'll call them Dr. Willemitzer and Dr. Wang. Yeah. Thank you both for being here. And you're listening to Wonder on The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. I am your host of The Morning Voice on Fridays, where we talk about business success stories in the first hour. In the second hour, we talk about Wonder, where we talk about great things going on, wonderful things, if you will, at the University of Arizona. Our guest for this segment is Dr. Jared Mosher. He is with the University of Arizona Department of Emergency Medicine. Good morning, Dr. Mosher.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So you work in emergency medicine, specifically critical care, and that's vital. Can you kind of describe your focus in the field of what you're doing in terms of critical care?
Yeah, so I trained in emergency medicine, and then I did a fellowship post-residency training, another 2 years in critical care. So clinically, I work in the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
I run our ECMO program, so I take care of the sickest of sick patients that come into the hospital.
And there are obviously the breath of life is important. So
yeah.
Being able to breathe is part of critical care, right?
And that's
so
right.
Your team and you work on that part of things, right? Other people work on other things, but you're working on trying to get people to be able to stay alive.
Yeah, that's right. So, it doesn't matter how good you are with anything else. If you can't establish an airway to put your patient on life support, nothing else will matter that you can do. So that's what we tend to focus on.
Right, right. And so you're basically in critical care, meaning that you are dealing with the sickest of the sick up in the ICU.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in emergency medicine where, anybody can come into the emergency room with a broken arm or whatever and come in, and they're not going to necessarily need intubation. They're not going to necessarily need that life-saving stuff.
Right.
They got to get fixed up, but maybe it's not as critical, and that's why they call it critical care, right?
Right, right, yep.
And so you're an important cog in the wheel of healing and trying to get people through some pretty crucible in their life where there's some major thing going on and you're trying to keep them alive, right?
Yeah, well, I would like to see it. I would like to think it's a critical cog in the wheel. I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. So one of your recent studies explores how to improve emergency intubation. And what did you find out from that research? And first off, what is intubation?
Mm-hmm.
And then what kind of research did you do on that? So
yeah, intubation is where you have to put your patient on life support. You have to put a breathing tube in. And that requires placing a tube, usually through the mouth, mm-hmm. into the windpipe. And, through lots of evolutionary changes, the body doesn't necessarily like having things go mm-hmm. into the windpipe, right? And so there's a lot of anatomic structures that need to be moved out of the way, a lot of reflexes that you have to take mm-hmm. away with sedating medications in order to get a tube into the windpipe. And it can be a dangerous procedure. So in order to do that, you have to give somebody potent drugs generally to render them unconscious. And then you have to give them a muscle relaxant so that they're paralyzed so that you can do the procedure. And the sicker you are, the more dangerous that is. And that's one of the things that I'm particularly interested in. And historically, it used to be an anatomic problem.
Mm-hmm.
The way we would move the tongue out of the way is with a direct laryngoscope where you'd have to directly visualize the airway. And then in the probably early to mid-aughts, video laryngoscopes were invented that put a camera on the end of the laryngoscope blade. And I did a lot of early work on trying to compare those two modalities, video laryngoscopy versus direct laryngoscopy. And then what we started to figure out was that a lot of these anatomic problems were solved, but yet the mortality and danger that comes from putting somebody on a ventilator, the actual procedure of it, did not go away. And that was right around the time when H1N1 happened. And so we got a lot of practice at people who were really sick. So we coined this term, the physiologic difficult airway, because we found that really where the most danger still relies is in putting somebody who's critically ill asleep, trying to put them on a ventilator. We've got the physiologically difficult airway.
Right.
And then, you know, we've done a lot of work in that. And then one of the things that we've started to figure out is that decision-making, the human factors aspect of doing a procedure, is a very stressful procedure. Right. It's a very stressful time. You have a patient who comes in and you're going to make them unconscious and try to put them on a breathing machine.
And they have other complications. They may be really sick.
That's
and
right.
Some other thing is going on, heart, brain aneurysm, whatever it is.
That's right, yeah.
It could be a zillion other things going on, and you're trying to sedate them and put a tube down their throat.
Exactly.
Try to save their life.
Obviously, that's a very stressful situation because what if you can't get it, right? And there's lots of algorithms that exist. It turns out if you put somebody under stress, they tend to make the wrong decision, even though they know what the correct decision is. It's all human factors related. And so our current methods of simulation are inadequate to try to study
you,
that.
You can't that replicate that stress, can you?
Correct. Yeah, you can't. So what we try to do is figure out, all right, how can we develop a way that we can put somebody under realistic stress? In medical simulation currently, there's high fidelity simulators, and high fidelity means that the actual mannequin, you can make it look like it's breathing and that kind of stuff. But it's not very realistic in terms of the human factors aspect.
Right.
Virtual reality is coming along. And the problem with virtual reality is, I can control what you see and all that stuff, but you have to suspend reality a little bit because you can't feel what you're looking at.
Right.
So we invented a simulation modality that combines those two realities. It's called mixed reality simulator. It combines virtual reality with a physical mannequin. And we just got a patent for this, actually, where those two realities merge is through the interaction with the patient via the laryngoscope. So you put the laryngoscope in the mouth, and these pressure sensors on the laryngoscope tell the game engine what to show you. And it took a long time for us to develop that, train it and everything. And so now we can put you under a more realistic scenario and induce stress with the hopes of, A, can we train people how to better do this? And B, can we get a glimpse at why people make the decisions that they make when they're under stress?
Right. And why do they make interesting decisions while they're under stress? Is because their brain is firing in a nanosecond, and they're making decisions under this pressure. And so they've been trained, but they might make a decision that isn't what they were trained to do. Basically,
great question. So when we are under stress or our bandwidth is strapped, we tend to make decisions based off of heuristics.
So we could be tired. We could be – this is our 14th one we've done today. It could be a zillion different reasons.
Or the pressure's really high. They're pregnant,
And, they're really on the teetering on the edge here, and it's up to you to get the intubation in there in order for them to keep them alive.
That's right.
It's all on you.
That's right, yep. Yeah. And so you may tend to rely on – what you're most comfortable with instead of maybe what's the best for the patient. And you start to conflate whether those things are the same thing, right?
Right.
And then let's say you make your attempt and you fail that, and now the patient's desaturating, they're heading towards cardiac arrest. Now what do you do? And people tend to keep going back to the same thing over and over again and perseverating on that.
Right.
Because they
go back to the right same thing they were just doing, trying to get it to go, and it's not working.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's this theory called prospect theory, where you tend to obsess about the risks of changing your path.
Right.
And ignore the very real risks of staying on the path that you're on.
Mm-hmm. So that is very stressful, isn't
it?
Yeah. And so this is what you're trying to mitigate, is trying to give some training and try to get them to be able to assume that risk and that stress and be able to succeed.
The idea is if we can figure it out, maybe we can hack it and train you out of it.
Right. And airway management is, like you say, it's an urgent priority because in emergency departments, there probably are some people that come in that don't just have a broken leg, but they're they're on their way to the ICU, but they're in the emergency department, and they don't have critical care yet, but they're in emergency situations. This is also an important place that intubation takes place, right?
Yeah, and the difference between the two locations is really the number of other distractions. So in the ICU,
there's a million distractions in the emergency room, right?
Yeah, if you look at what emergency departments have evolved into. Right?
I was in one the other day, and it's amazing. People everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah. So
screaming, crying, bleeding, you know, just horrible situation. Dr. Lane was telling me that part of that problem is because, you know, the state law says when they come in the door, you have to be treated. And so they may not be at a critical level, but they still have to be treated. You can't turn them away, so.
Yeah, I mean, this is a bit of a sidebar, but emergency departments are really the canary in the coal mine for the healthcare system. And if you look at the number of emergency department visits over time, over the last 30 or 40 years, they're just escalating almost logarithmically, but not quite, whereas the number of emergency departments are flat or even down, right? And so access to primary care, all those things lead to more and more people going to emergency departments.
And not enough beds and not enough room in the emergency departments to take care of the hundreds of people that are showing up, and that creates another situation.
That's right.
Well, when we come back after the break, we're talking with Dr. Jared Moiser. He is at the University of Arizona Department of Emergency Medicine. We'll talk about intubation and how his research is helping to translate to better patient outcomes in high-stress situations. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KVOI 1030 AM. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. We're talking about Wonder, the good things going on at the University of Arizona. One of the good things going on at the University of Arizona is Dr. Jared Moiser. After you told me how to pronounce it, I went ahead and butchered it. Sorry about that. You're at the U of A Department of Emergency Medicine, and so you work at the intersection of research and real-time emergency critical response. How do you balance those roles between research and actually saving lives on a daily basis?
That's a great question. I don't know that I do a good job balancing them. I think I just do full-time both.
Yeah.
I have a wonderful team of people that I work with that can help me carry out the research. A lot of stuff goes on the back burner for a while until I get a chance to work on it.
Yeah, because you're called into a place to save a life, and your research kind of has to pause while you go do those things.
Yeah, right? Well, I try not to give up too much clinical time because I don't want to not be good at it.
Yeah, yeah. What does training look like for physicians who want to specialize in critical airway? Your new approach of blending those two modalities together. But what does the training look like in the future for physicians who are trying to do what you're doing?
Great question. I think there's more and more focus on airway management as a core competency, a procedural skill, as ICUs go from open units to closed units, and the intensivist is in charge of managing the patient from start to finish.
Right.
There's more focus on training and fellowship training on airway management as a core skill. We have a national course that we do a few times a year in different cities around the country that people come for 3 days to Boston or San Diego or Nashville or whatever, and we run a three-day course.
So your research then and what you're looking at and how you're melding these two modalities together to give the training with both AI and a physical mannequin and so forth, you're actually helping advance this critical care across the country and around the world because you're training some people and what your research is providing you and your team, but it's also you're sharing this with other folks, right?
Yeah, to me, it's one of the most fulfilling things because you're able to increase your bandwidth of number of people that you can help rather than just one individual patient that you see.
So as you know, maybe you become more important as we talk about the cog in the wheel. How does collaboration between departments when you're in this critical care situation, whether it be emergency medicine guys, anesthesiologists, critical care people, how does that collaboration enhance patient outcomes in these high-pressure scenarios?
If you're invited to come help someone in a location where you don't know anybody, that you're unfamiliar with the equipment or the personnel, and it's a stressful situation, that's the recipe for disaster.
Right.
And so collaborating across these specialties to all speak the same language, have the same thought process, I think that's important. That's the way we need to go in the future.
Right. So that you're not in silos, but you're collaborating and people know what you're doing and you know what they're doing. And
that's right.
You're trying to achieve the same goal, which is obviously to save a life.
Yeah, and mutual respect for each other's skills, not just superficial respect for each other's skills.
Right. So this is a kind of a basic question, because you wouldn't have chose medicine if you didn't think that it was something that is a higher calling. But what inspires you personally to continue pushing the boundaries of emergency care and critical care and innovation in this stuff? What's pushing you to do that?
I think there's a lot of unanswered questions mm-hmm. that we need to fill these gaps in, as things like H1N1, COVID, whatever the next version is.
Yeah, we may not even know what's coming down the line next, right?
That's
yeah.
right. If you look over the last decade, there was H1N1, COVID, MERS, Zika, Ebola, all these threats that we're trying to break into major problems, and COVID just happened to be the one that broke through. But there will be more, and hopefully not to the scale that we just went through, but there will be more, and we need to be better prepared on how we can take care of these sickest patients so that we're not putting bodies in refrigerated trucks again.
Right, right. And the critical care part of this is really critical. And this is when human beings are at the hanging on by a thread.
Yeah.
And so one of the things we talked about was when they're in this state, and you have to intubate, and you have to give them these medicines in order to get them to be able to take the intubation. That's always stressful too, because how much do you give them, and does that exacerbate the problem, and could the medicine actually be a critical factor?
That's right. Yeah, there's two major threats. One is the medications that we use, right? In order, your adrenal glands are squeezing your endogenous adrenaline is keeping you alive, and that has cardiovascular effects.
Right.
Effects makes your heart beat faster, keeps your blood pressure up, and the drugs I'm going to give you to make you go to sleep affect that, and they counteract that, and all of them counteract it to a varying degree and in different locations. And one of the things that I teach is that it's sort of disrespectful to your body's cardiovascular system to just think that we can give you a little fluid or give you a different drug and whatnot. It's more complex than that. And so one of the things I'm working on is how do we figure that out quickly and modify the drugs that we use?
That's great. Well, critical care is obviously very important in the whole scheme of things. And you spend most of your time on the 6th, 7th, and 8th floors at Banner University. And you're teaching other physicians your craft and what you're doing. And I call it a craft. It's actually a science. It's more of a skill. It's actually an art in many ways, because this is an important amalgamation of a lot of different tools that you've learned over the years.
That's right.
Now you're sharing that information with others. Well, good luck to you in the future. We're talking with Dr. Jared Mosher. He is with the U of A Department of Emergency Medicine, talking about how important it is in life-saving critical care to perform intubation on patients who are at the real crossroads in their lives. And so the future looks good for you and the new research that you have. It looks like you're going to have a lot of people that are interested in this, right?
I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you for being here today. And
thanks for having me.
We'll have you back to talk about your future research.
I look forward to it.
Okay. Thank you for joining us today on The Morning Voice and Wonder. We'll be back next Friday with Success and Wonder from the University of Arizona. You're listening to KVOI 1030 AM, and this is The Morning Voice.